Hello.
Blog
Talk
Radio.
Wendell White. Hi, this is Roy Paul. I'm guest hosting this edition of The Gist of Freedom. How are you this evening?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm honored to be talking with you. You are a photographic historian, I would call you, and you have done an amazing job by documenting historical black towns like Gouldtown, New Jersey, which was established in 1690, the oldest black town in the United States. First, talk about your background experience, why you got interested in photography, and then segue into this project.
Sure, and I would just make a slight modification, since there's a actual discipline of photographic historian, and I'm a little bit different than that in the sense that I sort of define myself as a photographer and artist who uses historical material as part of the subject matter or the content of the work that I do. And in fact, in that context, it's really the sort of visual things that drive it the most. And so sometimes, certainly the historical part, I always, you know, have a caveat in the sense that I want to make sure everybody understands that I do everything that I can to make my work as accurate as possible. But at the same time, I don't necessarily approach it from the point of view of making decisions about what's the most important and what's the least important in a broader historical context in the way that a true historian might. The project that you're talking about that happened to include an image of Gouldtown was a project that I started in about 1989, and it came about really several years earlier, in 1986, when I was leaving New York. I had actually been working at Essence Magazine, and I got the teaching position at Stockton College, where I am now. And before leaving, I met with a friend who grew up in Philadelphia and had spent some of her summers with relatives in a small town in southern New Jersey called Whitesboro, and other towns as well. And so she just had said to me, you know, you're going in that direction, maybe you would be interested in one of these towns. And I kind of kept it in the back of my head. And one day in 1989, I decided to head out, and I started with Whitesboro, went to town, started making photographs, gradually started to meet people, and then the project just grew from there, and eventually I started photographing other communities. When I first started, I really didn't have in mind how extensive the project would be. I really just started with this one idea that the one community might be interesting to me.
You know, when you talk about how extensive that process is to put this project together, talk about that in detail. What are the things that you consider before taking on such a project, and then segue into how it evolved in terms of going there, meeting people, et cetera?
Right. Well, I do begin work like, and this is where, this is the part of my practice that is much more like an artist than a historian, in that I begin the work based on a kind of intuition or a notion that there are elements in an idea, a small idea about a place or a thing that might be of interest to me. And I often don't start out with the larger picture in mind, because I want to, first of all, see whether or not there are aspects of the subject that I think I can turn into photographs. Because that's, of course, the most important part to me, is whether or not I can make a visual representation of the ideas or of the places and all of those things coming together. So I do start very small. But then I'm always interested in, even though I start small, I'm interested in projects that seem like gradually they are going to lead into wider and wider directions, wider implications, and have bigger themes associated with them. Once I then get started with the larger themes is where I really get involved with combining both the art-making process with research and reading and interacting with members of the community, depending on all the different elements of the different projects. And I now have several different projects that overlap the idea of either, you know, African-American landscape, communities, artifacts, architecture. All of those things are now becoming increasingly part of a set of overlapping concerns in different photographic projects that are connected, and they've all grown out of that Small Towns Black Lives project.
Mm-hmm. Now, this might be something that would be more aligned, my question, with photographers yourself. What story do the pictures tell?
Well, you know, it's always a challenge. I mean, I think that the initially, you know, for me and the way I work, I think there are a lot of approaches to using the tool, and the tool, you know, might be of photography and of working with the camera as a way of making images. You know, there are a lot of different ways in which the pictures might unfold a particular story, and in my case, I've used different ways of doing that in different projects. In the project that included the Small Towns Black Lives, which are the African American communities, historically African American communities in southern New Jersey, one of the things about that project was, after I began the project photographing in Whitesboro, it became evident to me that, you know, one of the things that was happening was everyone that I encountered wanted to tell me their story or the story of the community or some story associated with what was taking place. Then, and I sort of kept records of all of that and hadn't really quite thought about doing something other than making the photograph by itself. After that, I started making some photographs of just a small cemetery in Port Republic, New Jersey, and so there was no community left. It had once been a black community, and then that community died out in about the 1920s or so. People moved away or, you know, just didn't stay within that community, but it had been kind of a vibrant community, and what was left were five headstones, four of which were Civil War, African-American Civil War veterans, USCT troops. And so my research led me to the National Archive in Washington to get, and that was at a time when, you know, there was very little, at that time actually none of this information was available on the internet, and certainly it was at a time that was before we had, you know, sort of the World Wide Web. So even the internet that existed at that time was purely sort of text-based and kind of difficult to navigate. So I traveled to Washington, copied all this information out of their veterans folders, and it unfolded this remarkable story. And I realized that there was really no way to infuse that story into just the pictures of these headstones. So no matter what I did in terms of creating, you know, even if I created a marvelous photograph of the headstone, it wouldn't be able to convey that story. And so that led to me actually combining the text and creating narratives, written narratives, that went along with the photograph. And I continued that throughout the project. So that project has, you know, 70 images, most of which, I think about 65 of which, are all paired with a text panel. And the way I've talked about it is that what I tried to do was hinge together both the visible and the invisible narratives of these black communities so that you could see in the photograph the world that existed for me at the moment that I encountered this community, a person, a place, a building, in the case of the Port Republic Cemetery, these headstones. But then at the same time, you had attached to that a large panel of text that provided you with information about what couldn't be represented in a photograph, and that was the history that brought that place to that moment in time, all of the information that had taken place and all of the sort of narrative that had taken place before I got there and made the photograph.
Yeah, you talked about the history and
right.
The remarkable story. What is the history? What is the story? You mentioned Whitesboro, Ghoul Town. Talk about the historical perspective of those places.
Well, the interesting thing about them in southern New Jersey in particular, and this is, you know, one of the things I would add to this is that obviously there are, and I know that most listeners would understand this, but that there are historically African-American communities spread throughout most of the, you know, United States, throughout most states, have these kinds of communities that were established apart from the white communities for various reasons at different parts, at different points in time. I found it interesting that in southern New Jersey it was rather unique in that there was this wide range of communities stretching back to the 17th century, as you referred to in the beginning, a place like Ghoul Town, you know, that was settled and established at that time, all the way up to the 1960s was the community, the most recent community that I had photographed, and that community being a group of African-American Jews that had sort of migrated out of Philadelphia looking for a more utopian environment to live their lives away from the city. Obviously, in the 1960s, the idea of, you know, what was taking place in the urban setting was, you know, a tremendous amount of turmoil. So they were looking to say, okay, we want to go out into a natural environment where we'll, you know, live in this sort of peaceful utopian environment. So all throughout that history, and of course the only incorporated town that's actually, you know, its own municipality in southern New Jersey is Lawnside, which came along. And even though it's, as a community, was much older, it was not incorporated until the beginning of the 20th century. But all of these communities from, you know, the antebellum era, so even, you know, pre-Revolutionary War, all the way up to the mid 20th century, were established for all of these different reasons all throughout the area. Again, some of them, one of them, a kind of group of freed slaves that had separated off from the Quaker plantation and therefore settled that community. I don't really know the explanation for the Port Republic community, which was settled before the Civil War. So there was a group of African Americans that lived near Woodbury, and they started purchasing land in Port Republic before the Civil War. So that's a kind of that story remains somewhat of a mystery to me, although only recently I discovered one of the descendants of that community for the first time living in Indiana. So I'm hoping to know more about that story.
What was that conversation like with that descendant?
Well, I mean, in fact, I think that in some ways I have I had more information about his family than he had, and so I was able to sort of fill in a lot of materials. We are actually planning to meet. He lives in Indiana. He's a superintendent of a school system in a small town in Indiana, and he's going to be coming to New Jersey to see the site for the first time. And so I'm hoping to, you know, find out more about what he knows about his family history. But I think that the materials that I had, a lot of it, he was seeing really for the first time. So he didn't really know quite as much about that early family history as I had accumulated. But it's been so far, wonderful, and it's been very exciting to me because I've learned so much about the people that lived in this community, and I've never seen anyone that was connected to the community or personally. So I've seen a couple of photographs of people that had lived in the community, but the settlement essentially is completely gone. In fact, it's in an area where there's no longer an African American community at all. It's in a town that's essentially an all-white town today. So,
yeah, now, if I can ask, I have this buzzing question in my head, and I'm sure there are other viewers of the Gist of Freedom who are saying, how on earth did you find this descendant in Indiana?
And I'll say that the great thing about it has been that, I have maintained a web presence since the mid-1990s for this project and other projects, and he just so happened he was, searching for his family names on the Internet, and he came across my website, and he contacted me. So, that was a tremendous amount of luck, and really all along I've had a tremendous amount of luck when it comes to that. I have three portraits of people that had lived in that community. One of them, I believe, is his grandmother when she was a young girl in the little school in Port Republic. And all of them came to me through just sort of interesting coincidences of people hearing about my project, and they happened to, in one case, a man came across a photograph that was well labeled and identified, and he actually remembered that his grandmother had this friend that had been his grandmother. He and his grandmother are white, but she had been friendly with members of this community, and she had a portrait of one of the women in that community in her album. When she passed, he actually, he gave me that photograph because he knew I was working on the project. So those kinds of things have happened, and I have to say I've been, tremendously fortunate as people have shared information with me. Persistent as I search for information, but I can't say that I'm that skilled.
Did you connect with any other descendants?
No, this is the first time, and I've had a couple of close calls where people have said to me, oh, they know of people who, were related, but then by the time, we were able to follow up, there just didn't seem to be any response. The phone numbers were no longer, any good, so they sort of led to dead ends with that regard. And that's that's the one community where, there's really... It's been interesting because there was no one there anymore. Most of the communities, really, that I photographed, really, there are still people living in the communities. Really, all of the other communities that I have photographed, there are people living in those communities. So they're able to talk about that history, and they're connected to, they know the history of their communities, and it's very vibrant. And even though they may have dwindled, places like Springtown in Greenwich Township, New Jersey, which is another sort of early community, and not too far from Gouldtown. The church was established in 1810 there. The community is small, but the church is still active, and, there are still a handful of members. And I suppose, there will come a time when maybe all of that is diminished and there no longer are members of that community living or living in that area that, know the history of that community. But the church is on the National Register, and I believe they've done a good job of recording quite a bit of information from, elderly members of that community.
Yeah, I'm amazed. What was the name of that church?
That's Bethel AME in Springtown.
Okay. Were you surprised find out that these people who still live there knew of the history? I'm always amazed because, as we know, traditionally African Americans, by and large, do not know much about
right.
the history. But it seems as though in those particular towns, you ran off a whole list of names, the
right.
descendants seem to be really engaged and are aware of their ancestry.
Right. I mean, I think that it's probably complex in that there are certainly a number of people living in these communities that aren't, that don't know that history and aren't interested. But there are people in the communities that, you know, have maintained that. They tend to be of the older generation, although not universally. I've met a number of younger, you know, people. I would say, when I say younger, people under 50 certainly, and even some in their 20s and 30s that have, you know, really taken the time to learn about their community and to be interested and engaged and involved in their community, take a lot of pride sort of in knowing, you know, that history. And especially when they're in the presence of a structure, I think that that helps, you know, provide a kind of centerpiece for pride. So places like Springtown having a church, which they, you know, were able to get money and resources to help restore to its original appearance. And you know, if there's a significant site, there's also the Mount Zion AME Church over in Swedesboro, which is, that section was called Small Gloucester, and the cemetery associated with it. So there's a physical, you know, presence in that community that even younger people can sort of connect to and look at. Although the Mount Zion a church, which is an Underground Railroad site as well, is outside of town. So what's interesting there is it's another example of a church that's now isolated in a sense from the black community, but they still have an active membership. And the black community essentially moved into town over time. Originally, I think, you know, in the development of Swedesboro, there was an initial desire to keep the black community separate from the white community, but as the town grew, it became inconvenient. And so, you know, there was essentially a section of the downtown area that was set aside for the black community, and so that drew people in from this more outlying region so that they became part of the downtown area. As a result, all that property around the church has, you know, gone to developers and, you know, the building of a new high school and all that sort of stuff, and so there is no black community there anymore.
Yeah, I'm always amazed with certain communities because there's always an origin attached to the name. And you mm-hmm. mentioned Gold Town, and I know that was named after one mm-hmm. of the surnames of the founders. Do the other names have any significance? You know, Lawnside, Springtown, those other right. names, are they connected in any way with history?
To the extent that I know, not so much. I mean, they're sort of connected to things that are, you know, sort of related to the geography or to a kind of information that sort of grew out of, you know, and I would say sometimes maybe it's even a name that's given to the section of the township, the larger township. Again, most of these are part of larger communities. Whitesboro, yes, because it was a land development project named after George H. White, who was the congressman in North Carolina, and he was looking for a place actually to develop land and develop properties so that people from his district could resettle. This is Whitesboro gets established a couple of years after the 1898 riots in Wilmington, North Carolina, and that was the area that he was, you know, a congressman for. He was the last African American congressman to serve until the modern era, and he was the last of the Reconstruction era. And one of the things that was interesting there is that you still see today families connected between Whitesboro, New Jersey, and you know, the towns in the area around where George H. White lived, and so they still have that connection to North Carolina. So that one is a specific one. But Lawnside actually had started out with another name. It was originally called Snow Hill. Again, these are sort of, you know, geographic ways of thinking of these names. Springtown was literally located right by a spring that you can still, you know, people point out where it used to be. It has dried up, you know, but they actually still can identify where the spring was at the time. So things like that become part of the names of these communities. The black Jewish settlement doesn't really have a name, except that I've always identified it by the name of the synagogue, which is Adat Beit Moshe. And so, you know, that becomes a way of identifying it, but in a sense it actually doesn't, you know, have a particular name. It's just a small cluster of homes and a synagogue.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to gaining the trust of the subjects, you mentioned that a lot of the descendants are a little older. And they may not be as willing and comfortable coming forward and telling their story. How do you get in there and say, hi, you know, I'm Wendell White and I'm doing a project on X, Y, Z and I need your help?
Right. I think that, you know, I was I think that I was fortunate in two different ways. One, the project started at a period of time when there was a tremendous amount of neglect in terms of the stories of these communities, as well as these specific communities. So people were living in communities that I think they thought were remarkable. They liked, they loved their communities. They were more or less, you know, peaceful, suburban / rural or sub-rural kinds of communities, depending on where they were located. Lawnside is more suburban. Springtown is really a rural community. So all of them are sort of located in different settings. You know, Cape May has a small community, and that's a more of a town setting. So each one of them are a little bit different. But at the time that I started in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know, people really had not paid much attention to these communities at all. In fact, the small Gloucester settlement, the way I got to know them was that one of the women in that community knew that I was making photographs through a relative of hers who lived in another town that I was photographing, and she wanted me to come because they were trying to save the cemetery, which was being threatened by development. And so it was a kind of desperation. They had already lost what they thought were significant landmarks. For instance, the original African-American school in that community, which had been built by the community, was they tried to preserve it, and the town knocked it down. They had even gone to the state, you know, up through the court systems to the state level to try and block the town from knocking it down because they wanted it as a historical landmark, and they were unsuccessful. So, you know, those kinds of things were happening on a regular basis throughout the 70s and the early 80s that, you know, the towns were not seeing this black history as, you know, a significant thing which they could establish partnerships with the black community to begin building historical tourism. That sort of that phrase of historical tourism, you know, wasn't even on the radar screen. So I think that one of the things that was in my favor was that I was coming along at a time when people were eager, I would say would be a good description, to, you know, leave behind some information about the story that they were involved in. I think I was also fortunate because I had the connection to the college. So as I, you know, met with people, even if they didn't know me, they had a sense, you know, as I told them that I was a faculty member at Stockton College, that meant something. It gave me a kind of official connection to the community, to South Jersey. They understood, you know, the college's relationship to the environment, and so that helped. Also, once I started with Whitesboro, really, in each community, everyone knows new people in the other communities. Choirs went back and forth and visited each other's churches, etc., and family members had relatives in other communities. And so many of the connections happened through references that people, you know, provided me. So after I met with someone and photographed them, they said, well, you know, you might be interested. You know, first of all, they'd say, do you know about this town? And I'd say, well, no, I don't really know that town. And then they, you know, would say, well, I know somebody in that community that would probably help you.
What is the name of the lady that you were just referencing?
Elaine Edwards.
Elaine Edwards, okay.
Right, in Swedesboro.
In terms of preserving the legacy of these towns and in these communities, you mentioned that that was fading. Do you find that there's a resurgence of that? People are getting more interested and involved in learning about these communities.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, just last year I worked on a project, a commission project for the County of Salem to photograph seven sites that they have now developed a cell phone history tour around, which they call Seven Steps to Freedom, that document everything from, you know, the early slaves escaping from slavery, coming across the Delaware River, where they were landing in Salem County, to the buildings which are still standing where, you know, individuals lived as slaves in the community. So there were sort of these two things which were going on. New Jersey is wonderfully complicated in that way, in that, you know, slaves were escaping from Delaware and Maryland and coming to New Jersey to seek out freedom, but at the same time, and there were Quakers in this community, especially in Salem County, there were Quakers that were helping the runaway slaves. And at the same time, you know, that they were doing that, other members of the black community were still living as slaves. And working as slaves within that same community. In fact, it's fascinating because Colonel Johnson's home, where he, you know, held slaves, is practically across the street from the Goodwin sisters' home, where, and they were, you know, abolitionist Quakers that helped. And it's and in fact, in New Jersey, I think it's the only official national network to freedom underground railroad site. I mean, the other sites are well documented, and I think there are certainly a number that are well accepted as underground railroad sites, but the one that is actually on the National Network of Freedom is the home of the Goodwin sisters there in Salem County. So I, as they've developed this cell phone tour with the idea, and they're the poorest county in the state, they're among the, you know, one of the 400 poorest counties in the nation. So, you know, they are really looking to the history of that community and how remarkable that history is, that leads all the way up to, you know, the Civil War and African Americans living in that county, you know, serving in the Civil War. So that whole trajectory from slavery all the way to the Civil War becomes what they establish as the Seven Steps to Freedom project, as a way of bringing in people to the county to see, you know, this remarkable history, and hopefully, you know, with that comes development for them.
Yeah, I think that was amazing. That was a wealth of information that they should be teaching in schools, but they're not, and we'll get to that in a second. Tell us about Peter Mott. What significance does that name have?
Right. Well, and that's another one of those. It's a good example of a project. It's the Peter Mott House is another abolitionist site located in Lawnside, New Jersey, and was one of the African. And this is one of the things that's another kind of interesting stereotype that gets developed, that the conductors and the members of the Underground Railroad were always white, but there were also African Americans that, you know, had established themselves in one way or another. And so, you know, Peter Mott's home was one of those places that also served as a location on the Underground Railroad in New Jersey. That site is located in Lawnside, and they've done a remarkable job of renovating that home, or restoring it, so that it has, you know, the characteristics that it might have had during the time of slavery, so that people can visit the site and get a feeling for, you know, what the house looked like and what the site was like. What's interesting, though, is that it's, you know, for people that don't know, the Lawnside is a fairly densely developed community today. Obviously, it wasn't always that way. And so there are a lot of newer homes that sort of surround it very closely. So in a place like Lawnside, which is very close to Philadelphia, you see all of the sort of development of a suburban community that has transformed the landscape around a site like Peter Mott House, whereas Salem County, which is much more remote and has less development, you know, it's sort of fascinating as you go down the main street there that, you know, many of those buildings and homes look the same today as they did, you know, in the 18th century.
You mentioned Lawnside, and I know that the Still family is very prominent from that area.
That's right. Talk
about that family and William Still. I know that there's a reunion that happens, if I'm not mistaken, right next to Peter Mott's house.
Yes, there is, and I have I wish I knew exactly what year they were up to now, but they're, you know, something like 130, 140, 150,
I believe 150 it's
years.
It's 144.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I knew it's a big number when you think about, you know, an African American family, you know, maintaining a kind of reunion and bringing people back together again. I really have connections to one person today from the Still family, and that was Clarence Still, Mr. Still, who lives in Lawnside, and he was my main sort of conduit in that community to talk about the history of that community and to connect me to the various people within that community and the various sites.
How did you develop a relationship with him? How did that start?
I'll be honest, I can't say I remember exactly. over time, there were so many different ones. I think that it was through a reference from someone else. So I think, and I just don't recall who connected me to him directly at this point. It probably would have been somebody like Elaine Edwards in Sweetsboro, because she's very closely connected with other, I know she has cousins or family members in Lawnside. So I think it would have probably been Elaine Edwards that would have said to me, you know, you want to talk to Clarence Still. And once I contacted him again, he was very generous. And even though for somebody like Mr. Still and in Lawnside, you know, there was, unlike many of the other communities, there had been already a long history of, you know, paying attention to the history of that community, paying attention to, you know, the importance of that particular settlement. And it had been, you know, written about in magazines, you know, back from the 1950s and earlier. And so it had this long history and presence of, you know, being recognized in various ways. I don't think that didn't mean that they still didn't struggle with, you know, trying to preserve their history. But at the same time, there was more a critical mass there, a larger community, more people, more churches, more institutions to help preserve, you know, that preserve that story.
Mm. The name Timbuktu.
Right.
Any significance that has?
Yeah, it's not a community that I have worked with, but I certainly know of Timbuktu and its location. I know that there's a project underway now to do more with the history of Timbuktu. I know that there are, and there are so many different locations just in New Jersey alone. I think, and I don't have it right in front of me, I just was in touch with somebody who's been very active in trying to catalog all of the different locations and sites, and I believe he has a list of about 135 settlements or locations or sites in all of just the southern counties of New Jersey. But that's where the concentration, you know, of the communities, you know, certainly is. The big concentration of these black communities in the state has been in the southern part of the state. It's easy to forget that the sort of concentration of black population in the northern part of the state is a more recent development in the history of New Jersey in particular. At one time, Atlantic City had the largest black population in the state, before Camden, before Trenton, before Newark, before any of those large cities that we now associate with large black populations. Atlantic City was the place that had the largest black population. Mm-hmm. And so that transformation was partly due to, and the presence, you know, was certainly partly due to the fact that, you know, the Quakers had a big influence over the southern part of the state and were more inclined or to be, well, they were less inclined to be hostile towards the idea of black settlement and black, you know, development and self control over black communities and throughout the area. So there was an environment that, in a sense, provided for the implantation of these communities and the development of these communities.
Yeah. I'm just curious to know, there are some other scholars in the field of restoring history and preserving history. I know there's
right.
Mr. Bloxon over at Temple University. Do you
right,
cross track with them? Do you find
yes, certainly. Well,
and then call them up and say, hey, what do you think?
Right. Now, I haven't had as much contact with Mr. Bloxham, but I certainly was, when I first started my project, I should say that, you know, I want to mention that Giles Wright, who's no longer living, was really instrumental, and he was, you know, headed up the Black History Project for the New Jersey Historical Commission, and I used his book, A Short History of African Americans in New Jersey, as my one of my initial guides to finding out about the various black settlements and towns in southern New Jersey. He was also, you know, and that's where, you know, we lost a tremendous amount when he passed, was that he was also very active in one of his pet projects was to really identify which of the so-called claimed sites in New Jersey for the Underground Railroad were real and which ones were, you know, just sort of fabrications, because people think, well, it would be nice to be able to say that, you know, the basement of my bar was a, you know, site on the Underground Railroad, as opposed to, you know, having any real documentation. So, you know, that was a tremendous project that he was involved in, and we lost that. I've worked closely with Clem Price, and he was very generous in writing what I thought was a very beautiful essay for the exhibition catalog of Small Towns, Black Lives. So folks like that have been very helpful to me. And then, you know, both black and white scholars in various locations, not only in New Jersey, but as my project has spread into locations outside of New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and even now this past summer I was in Nebraska and Iowa photographing and you know, trying to develop my project that's on objects in that location. You know, there are so many people that have been helpful along
the way. I'm just curious. We have a couple of minutes left in the show, and I want to get a couple of pieces in there. Were you able to photograph the Bordentown School?
Yes, and that, you know, took a tremendous amount of time. And Giles, that was one of the things that Giles Wright was tremendously helpful in. So I knew that he had been conducting an annual tour of the Bordentown School. And the problem was that the Bordentown School today is part of the New Jersey criminal justice system, and it's a detention center for female juvenile offenders, the Valentine Unit. And so it's obviously very difficult to, you know, call them up and say, hey, I'd like to come and bring my camera and, you know, take pictures. And so he was very helpful in referring me to the you know, the right folks in the state who, you know, provided him with permission to bring a tour of people onto the campus every year. And it took a while. It took me about a month or so of emails and letters and things like that back and forth. And again, I think once again, my, you know, position at the as a faculty member at a state college helped, and also when I went to Bordentown School to photograph, it was after the Small Towns Black Lives Project had been, you know, completed and the exhibition was touring around the state. So there was some recognition, I think, for my work. So all of that helped. But they were very generous.
For those who don't know about the school, however, there might be some people listening who don't know much about that particular school. Give us some history about it.
Sure. Originally called the New Jersey Manual and Industrial Training School for Colored Youth, and sort of referred to by Bordentown School. It's a remarkable site. It's about 90 acres, or at least the original campus was about 90 acres, still takes up most of that space. There are about a dozen or so very large, substantial buildings on the property, several of which are no longer in use but are being preserved by the state. And it served as a boarding school, and I believe the only state-run boarding school for African Americans in a northern state. And it operated as a segregated school, really, up until 1955. Which was very interesting because New Jersey Constitution outlawed, you know, segregated schools by 1948, and in a sense, the school was, you know, they dropped the word for colored youth and opened the school up to anyone. But after you know, many decades. The school was established at the end of the 19th century, and so after all these decades in which it had been come to be known, this significant, you know, black institution, you know, there were no whites that wanted to attend it, I think, at that point, and or felt comfortable or, you know, were interested in that. I always find that a kind of interesting, you know, thing to look at, is how often are whites really interested in, you know, participating in the desegregation process. You know, we, you know, always talk about the bravery of young black kids that, you know, throughout the history have been part of the desegregation process. But, you know, the other side of that story might be interesting as well.
I believe it was originally called the New Brunswick Technical Institute, and it was founded by a slave, which is...
Yeah, right, and minister in, exactly. And then was eventually, you know, purchased by the state and run by the state for a long time. The great thing about it is that this was really an interesting balance between the ideas of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, based on the different principles over time, in terms of the emphasis of whether or not it would be more vocational or whether or not it was going to be a classical college prep education. And for a long time, it really, you know, served in a way both, but the emphasis sort of quietly was on the classical, because it was a kind of political, you know, concern about, well, if we make this too much of a classical college prep, you know, curriculum, then it's not going to receive the support from, you know, conservative white legislators. So that was always downplayed, but it was always there. So students were learning Latin, and many of the alumni are still closely tied to the school, and you know, certainly many of them, you know, went on to, you know, professional careers and advanced degrees.
Yeah, talk about the Amistad Commission, because I mentioned earlier about the need to integrate this information into the curriculum now, so schools and students can learn about their history. Do you think that a good enough push is being made to sort of make students who are growing up now aware of this information?
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, I think it's the problem is very complicated, and I don't mean to say that as a way of, you know, letting anyone off the hook. I think it's an important problem. There was just an article today in the Atlantic City Press about the current issue of segregated schools, and how many schools in this state in particular. We live in New Jersey. It's a particularly highly segregated state because schools are all based on small localities, and so they're not countywide school systems, or they're not even, you know, very few places have regional school systems that encompass several towns. So every town has its own school. And so consequently, you know, black communities are, you know, and every, you know, certainly poor community, is, regardless of race, is concentrated in one school, and wealthy communities get concentrated in other schools. The things like the Amistad Commission are critical, I think, as we try to fill in the gaps that were missing in the history. But the other part of that piece is making sure, and I think the commission is addresses this piece to some extent, but to me, one of the things that's critical here is that the teachers in the schools and the administrators of the schools have to have as their mission, you know, this holistic approach to both history and education, et cetera. This is something that we didn't get in particular a solution to when the problem of segregation was more or less, you know, addressed in 1954 and 1955. No plan was really put in place other than, you know, moving people around eventually, but no plan was put in place to say, how are we going to address what it means to be in, you know, in institutions, and increasingly in institutions where the teachers are not an integral part of the community, that, you know, really, you know, bring all of the history of the community, bring all the history of the larger community of African Americans, or the larger community of any particular ethnic group. You know, that was always, you know, a given, I think, in the segregated schools, and we haven't yet come up with a good way of addressing that.
Are you involved in that process?
No, I was not. Not in any direct way, no.
Okay. Moving forward to the future, I don't know if this is something that's in the works, is any thought been given to turning this project from photography to the screen?
Not for me. I mean, for me, the current, you know, sort of form of expression has been, you know, has been the photographic image. And it's not, you know, that I'm adverse to that idea, but at least at this moment, I have still so many project ideas that I want to continue to pursue and unfold. And, you know, using the still photographic images is the way in which I'm, you know, working with those different project ideas, continuing to work with the landscape, photographing segregated schools, photographing objects that are in various collections around the country, you know, everything from a lock of Frederick Douglass's hair to the microfilm of the FBI transcripts of the investigations of Malcolm X, which was, you know, kind of remarkable. So all of those kinds of things that, you know, have to do with the black landscape in America are still things that I am, you know, really passionately involved with the still image and the camera.
Yeah, if you can, just a little bit talk about that Malcolm X project. That sounds fascinating.
Well, right. I was in, this was last summer, I spent 2 months as a artist in residence at Bemis Center for Contemporary Art in Omaha. And Omaha is the home of Malcolm X. And so in addition to a whole range of different aspects of life there, connections to Frederick Douglass, family members that had, you know, resettled out there, black life in Nebraska, all of those kinds of things, it was important for me to sort of find something. I was only photographing objects and only photographing things that were very symbolic of the black community there. And the thing that really connected for me was, you know, coming across in the State Historical Society their archives of microfilm of these FBI files on Malcolm X. And I thought it was just a kind of remarkable thing, and they're very clinical looking in these very pristine white boxes with, you know, type on the side of the boxes as the old sort of microfilm boxes looked. But it's just this notion that all of this information is contained inside these boxes about, you know, where the FBI was, you know, tracking everything that Malcolm X did. And I thought that it, you know, was just very powerful to see it in this very clinical, you know, small little white boxes contained in this way and stored in these collections. And that's the thing that I'm, and that's stored in the same collection as the, as a collection, as a piece of a lock of Frederick Douglass's hair and locks of hair of various family members, and as well as a wide array of other things.
Well, we should probably have you on in the future to talk about those projects in depth, because they sound quite fascinating to me just listening to you preface them.
Thank you.
Moving forward into the future, what's next? What do you have on the horizon in terms of whether it's expanding this project or another one?
Right. I hope to continue. It's always hard for me to cut off an old project entirely, but obviously new ones come on. But I am still, you know, very interested in photographing, you know, sites. I still want to continue to have somewhat of an emphasis in New Jersey, even though I'm, you know, traveling to other states more and more to photograph a variety of different things. I would like to continue building my archive of schools that I photographed. My current exhibition has 50 schools in it, but I could really see, you know, continuing to build that as I travel around the country and, you know, build a greater archive of images like that. And I just think it gets more powerful as we see larger and larger numbers of them. And but the project that I'm most involved in right now is finding out all these finding all these objects that have been locked away in libraries and in historical societies and all of those kinds of places that are connected to, you know, the history of African Americans from the beginning of, you know, the nation all the way up to basically up to the civil rights era. I'm not really continuing past that period of time, but I'm sort of looking from slavery to civil rights as the time frame that I'm documenting and photographing through objects and things like, you know, but I found this past summer I found a button, a political button, the Eldridge Cleaver for president, you know, all of those kinds of things just remarkable things that are stored in all of these locations all around the country.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. How can people find more about your work and your book?
My website is wendelwhite.com. It's WendelWhite.com. And there's links to all of that information. The Small Towns Black Lives book is generally available on Amazon, although, you know, it's been a little while, so it may not, you probably have to buy it through Amazon, but through a third-party seller. And, you know, any news and information about projects and things that I'm doing generally goes up on the website.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wendell White. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to interview you about the phenomenal work that you're doing. And I hope that one of those exhibits ends up moving into New York City so that I can come and view them.
Absolutely.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who would love for this to be a roaming exhibit all over the country.
Right. Well, including me.
Yes. So if that happens, you know, of course, keep the Gist of Freedom in tune to what you're doing, and we'll have
Absolutely.
You back on the talk in the future.
And I want to thank you for, you know, taking the time to, you know, be interested in my work. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is history, and we should all know it. If you know your ancestry, you know where you're going in the future, and there are so many people who just don't have a clue. And
right.
We should do as much as we can with the knowledge that we have to educate people. So it's my pleasure.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Good night.